This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Growing up is one thing. Growing smart is quite another. I've got three pieces for you today about growing smart, and they cover life lessons, urban development, and hair. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. The theme of today's show is Growing Smart. Installment number one is from four women around town in Moscow, Idaho. Two women who are about 50 years old and two who are half their age answered some questions about what they know now that they wish they had known years ago.
How old are you?
How old am I? I am 24 years old as of yesterday.
And what do you know now that you wish you had known years ago?
I don't know much now. I wish I had known that, I don't know. I mean, I guess just what most young, I wish what most young girls know, would know, is that it's just okay to be who you are and not worry about it. Just own it. Doesn't matter.
And do you know that now?
I think I do. I mean, I know it, but I don't know that I live it all the time. So, yeah.
You lived it enough to know that it works?
Yes. I mean, whether or not it works for other people is a whole other thing, but mm-hmm. I feel like it works for me. And if everybody had it work for them, we'd probably live in a more, I don't know, tolerant, understanding, freer, cooler world with everybody just being themselves instead of worrying about whether or not they're cool in other people's eyes or whether or not they fit in or whether or not they're following social cues or mores or whatever.
Do you have any semi-specific advice for how to achieve it?
Just do what feels right. Don't care. I mean, to a certain extent, don't care what other people think. Don't let it affect you. I don't know. I think you first have to have a somewhat strong sense of self in order to not go down the wrong path of just kind of leaving catastrophe in your wake. But I don't know about specific advice. Just be conscious and self-aware and forthright and honest with yourself about who you are and what you feel. I think that's probably most important.
You want to ask me?
Okay. You asked yourself because I don't remember what you asked me.
So I'm 49 years old. Uh-huh. And what I know now that I wish I had known long ago was very similar. But I could phrase it a million different ways, but you said it was very similar to the way I feel about it. It's a self-awareness and a self-embracing and a not defining yourself according to what you may think others or society wants you to be. Mm-hmm. Another way I could say that, and it's related but it's a little bit different, is not waiting for your prince to come. Mm-hmm. Because life isn't going to just happen if you do all the right things. It's not going to happen. Happiness is not going to happen mm-hmm. if you just do the right things. it's important to do what makes you happy now. Mm-hmm. And it may not relate to building a career in the proper way, mm-hmm. or it might. If you're very driven and you see a long term, sure, do that. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, that's not important. And related to that with the prince part is nobody is going to be the thing in your life that, mm-hmm. that brings it together. It's your life.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a big picture thing. But it's a lot about owning yourself and believing in yourself that you have the right answers for you. Mm-hmm. My advice is turn off the TV.
Oh my God, yes.
I think the TV is where you get all the messages that you're supposed to be this and you're supposed to live life this way and aim for this, and you're not valuable unless you're skinny and beautiful and can sing and dance and have a man and gorgeous man and, you know, those kinds of things. And those kinds of things can be great, mm-hmm. but they're not most of us, and they don't. Anyway, turn off the TV. Mm-hmm. Turn off those messages so you can hear the own messages in your head. Mm-hmm. Don't let them compete.
That is really good specific advice. Totally. Okay, first of all, how old are you?
25.
And what do you know now at age 25?
What do I know now?
Much earlier.
I know now that it's okay to be different. I know that if there's something that you enjoy, you should just do it. And not worry about if your friends are doing it.
Cool. And if you were to advise someone who is that previous you, who didn't know it, would you have any tips or techniques on what to do differently to achieve that? Or how to just be happier or whatever?
I would say to explore everything to find out what it is that you do like and what kind of person you are.
And I was like, oh.
And don't say no to anything that's legal. Because you're not going to know if you like it, even as much as you think you might not. You won't know unless you try it. So you should try it. And what else? What other kind of advice? Be proud of what you like. Don't be ashamed. I think that's all the advice that I would have.
That's good. First of all, I ask, what's your age?
51.
What have you learned in life that you wish you had known when you were younger?
A lot. I think probably one of the first things I've learned is that life does not turn out the way you planned it to turn out. And you may have a vision that it's going to go a certain way, and it doesn't. And when it doesn't, I think that's an opportunity to learn more about yourself, to learn who you are, what you have inside. I think it's an opportunity to find out what's really important. There's a lot of things that people spend a lot of time on thinking are important, and I think a lot of people say this, and those things aren't important. We spend a lot of time collecting material wealth, we spend a lot of time raising our own status or building a career and all of that, and those things are vanished, they're gone. They're not our core of what we need to be. I think I would say that I learned through hardship and struggle and difficulty, you learn who you are. You learn what life is really about. The pretense and the BS doesn't matter anymore. It's gone. You have to cut the chase because time is limited, which you have. And
how you choose to spend your life, it has to be your choice.
So. If you were to advise either the younger you or a young woman to try to know those lessons without going, you know, by you telling them, what advice would you give them to try to achieve some of that or to try to learn those lessons?
I would speak for Allie, my daughter. You don't have to follow the norm. You don't have to be pigeonholed. Experiment. Try. Have courage and reach out to those things that you think may not be a possibility for you, and find out that they can be. So don't limit yourself. I would tell my daughter, do not limit yourself. It is all open to you. Every possibility that is in your head, if you want, you can achieve it. But not to go with the attitude of self-fulfillment, but the attitude of generosity and extending to others. That's what I would tell her.
To
make your way, but make sure you're making your way so someone else mm-hmm. has a chance to make their way.
It's a great lesson.
Yeah.
Can you read it? I can't. It says courage.
Oh, yeah, it is. That's what you need. Because life is going to toss you all kinds of crap. You don't have to look for the bad. But when it's good, you got to let it be great. Because bad's going to come. But when it's good, it has to be great. Really celebrate the great. And you're going to deal with the bad because it's going to happen. But it isn't what's in the future and it's not what's in the past. It's what's happening right now. That's the other thing I would tell her as a little girl. It's what's happening right now. Because you don't know what's going to happen 20 minutes from now or 20 years from now. And what's in the past is the past. Not that it's not part of our life, but it is the past and it doesn't change. That's what I would tell her.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Installment number 2, smart growth. Smart growth is a way to develop urban and suburban areas. It's an anti-sprawl development technique that is environmentally, physically, and economically smart. It is a surprisingly old-fashioned way to build communities. Elaine Clegg is the co-director of Idaho Smart Growth, and she serves on the City Council in Boise, Idaho. She spoke with me in May 2010 about the concepts, techniques, and results of smart growth.
Thanks very much for spending some time with me.
I'm glad to be able to do it.
I guess I wanted to start with the comment you made today that the U.S. DOT head has apparently fairly recently said that all modes of transportation, walking, biking, are to be treated equally important with these more traditional modes.
Yes, that's a big change, especially for U.S. DOT and FHWA. It's caused some consternation in the traditional transportation world among engineers, but the secretary backed it up with recommendations about how to implement policies around it. FHWA is going to come out with some guidance. So it's clear that he's serious about it. And the engineering world, I think once they got used to the idea, has began to understand that maybe that's their job now. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll figure out how to implement it.
Well, now I get the impression that the statement is really almost like getting on the bandwagon, something that's already been happening in many communities.
In some sense, you're right. Many communities have already determined that they're going to build their street and other transportation system to serve all users and serve them equally. But in the engineering world, that hasn't been the case.
So the engineering world and most of our worlds, especially suburbia's worlds, has been very car-centric.
Yes, yes.
And this statement means that there's going to be a push in any nationally funded projects, at least, to
at least projects.
Car-centric?
Yes, at least projects that get federal funding. And it's not that it's anti-car. I like to look at it as pro-bike and pro-walk and pro-young users and pro-old users and pro-disabled users and pro-car. Mm. How do we get everybody around safely? How do we get everybody to their destination in the most efficient way possible? And how do we do it without relying so much on oil, especially, you know, now with the oil spill, and we've known for years that we're so dependent on foreign oil. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can do this that can help this whole country reduce some of that?
And the question is there?
I think so. I think the evidence shows if you build these kind of communities, smart growth communities, if you will, communities that have a little more density, a lot of destinations, a mix of uses. Those kinds of communities are places where people walk and bike up to three or four times more often as communities that don't have those features. You can reduce vehicle trips and vehicle miles traveled by almost half in those kind of communities, depending on what all the characteristics are.
Let's talk a little bit about what those kinds of communities are. What does it mean to be a smart growth community?
Well, it means actually traditional small towns. If you look at, in Idaho particularly, the old parts of our traditional small towns are built to serve about 4,000 people per acre. They have the corner store and the school and the church and the other kinds of uses that you would need on a relatively frequent basis within walking distance or biking distance. And yet they're not, it's not asking anyone to live in a way that they don't want to. But it is asking people to live a little more compactly than we have. The difference between one unit per acre and 10 units per acre in density is where you gain all of your, nearly all from 30,000 miles a year traveled to less than 15,000 miles a year traveled by most people, by the average person.
Well, you said it's small town living, but I guess as I've heard smart growth described, I also picture old big cities, especially ones that were developed pre-car, so more European cities, New York in the U.S. and a few other cities, where even within a city you have communities that have shops and stores and local services and apartments above them.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes. I was describing it as a small town because I think a lot of people in Idaho are scared of it because they think of it as only big city. And big city is certainly a place where it can work very well, and even small city. I would say Boise, frankly, is a relatively small city. But you can, within the city of Boise right now, there's identified 9 different neighborhood regions. And within each of those regions, there's an activity center that serves that region and is walkable by the majority of the residents. The goal would be to have a place where the majority of the residents are within a mile of most of their uses, or at least a mile. Typically, people will say half a mile is better. But
and those uses are things like grocery stores and basic supplies?
Work, schools, grocery stores, the dentist office, the barber shop, the hair salon, the where do you typically go to get, you know, nails and thread and needles and those kind of things.
That makes sense. Density is not the only factor, though.
Not the only factor at all. Density is important, but not, you know, we're not talking, people think about density and they think of badly done apartment buildings. And certainly there were plenty of those in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. But it doesn't have to be badly done, and it doesn't have to be apartments. It can be small lot, single family houses. It can be very nice condos. Mm-hmm. But besides the density, you have to have the mix of uses. You have to have good transportation connections so that the destinations are accessible.
I guess one of those things in mixed uses we didn't talk about that I've heard you talk about before is the shared green space, the recreation space.
Yes. If you're going to ask people to live in more dense, more compact living conditions, then you also have to provide them with some public realm green space. People are happier when they have access to green space. And so, you know, figure out a way within a quarter of a mile to have some green space in walking distance of everyone. And it doesn't have to be very big. Ogden, Utah is a really interesting example. Every 9 blocks, there's one block that's a park. And
so just a block-sized park?
Not a very big park, but it's big enough for, you know, a tennis court, some picnic tables, a place to play a little wiffle ball or whatever, walk the dog.
Yeah. Well, in Moscow, it must be part of a plan, but just as a resident, I just noticed after I had been here a while that actually, it was a kid who pointed it out. Oh, there's a water tower over there. There must be a park. Let's go, Mom.
Oh, interesting. I've been noticing the water tower since I got here, too, but I hadn't associated them with the green space.
We have green space at every water tower I can think of.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Must be part of a plan.
Must be.
but back to smart.
It's an interesting pattern, anyway.
Yeah. So density is a factor, mixed use is a factor. What are some of the other factors? You pointed out the 4 Ds.
Yeah, density, diversity, design is another big factor. And, you know, I talked about the badly done apartment houses. There's a really nice condominium building in my neighborhood that got a lot of opposition when it was proposed. It was built about 6 years ago now, and was opposed mostly because it's dense. It's 43 units per acre, and people heard that number and immediately conjured up the worst design that they could think of. It got approved, and as it was getting built, the design, as it turned out, was very nicely done. It has a brick facade. It has a concrete foundation that sits above ground because it also has underground parking. Sits halfway above ground. And the concrete is formed well so that it appears like it's stones. It has some sandstone around windows, some nice little touches. And then the interesting thing that worked the best was that they painted the top story white. And once they did that, it disappeared. So it looks like a 2-story building, even though it's 3-story.
And it's in a residential neighborhood?
It's in a residential, otherwise residential neighborhood, and today very well accepted. Nobody complains about it. In fact, everybody says, gosh, it's one of the nicest buildings around here.
Yeah.
And 4 of the people who live there don't own cars.
Oh.
They don't even own one.
So the location is also in a good place for them to get around.
For them to get around. It's very near downtown. It's near two grocery stores. It's near a little commercial area that has shops and restaurants. Mm-hmm. So
I've seen a couple of experiments, probably in some of this thinking, one's in St. Louis, and I was just a visitor there, and they're turning old buildings, you know, from downtown that are lots being abandoned into really nice looking condominiums or apartments.
Right.
And a problem is you can tell by looking, plus I was told by people who live and work there who are trying to revitalize it, there's no services. So people don't want to move there.
Oh,
they would still have to drive somewhere. So they got part of it, but not all of it. And
yeah.
I also have seen that in downtown Tallahassee.
Okay.
That's my hometown.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that there's some attempts sometimes, but it seems like they don't have that whole...
Yeah, I really do like to talk about smart growth in all 4Ds. So, you know, density is important, design is important, diversity or mix of uses, and then finally those destinations that are connected well enough that they're within walking or biking distance. And so, you know, without one or the other, it sort of works. The more you have, the better it works. If you have all four, it's more likely than not to actually work.
Yeah.
So.
There's a couple of things I'd like to talk about. One is, what it looks like to the user. So let's say we have this really nicely designed, high density, mixed use area.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be the wide area, it may be a small area.
Yeah.
Let's paint a picture.
Sure. So the picture I would paint is imagine that you're in a more historic area. And it's not that the architecture has to be historic, but what you would feel that would feel more like that historic area is the way that the buildings enclose the space and make it feel as if it's human scale. So part of it is getting that relationship between buildings and human beings such that when you're a human being on foot or on bike, you don't feel isolated, you don't feel lonely, that the building is within 10 or 20 or 30 feet, and that feels like a comfortable distance. The other thing that would feel more like a historic neighborhood than not is that you're likely to see all kinds of different sizes and types of architecture and buildings. So rather than just seeing row after row after row of, you know, cinder block commercial buildings or nicely designed houses, you'd see a variety. You'd see, and it would probably, farther you got from the center, it would become less and less intense. So if you were close to the center, it might be three or four stories, would be pretty tightly packed, would still be nicely designed. There'd be a variety of, you know, different kinds of architecture and style. As you moved a little bit further out, you might then begin to see some of the housing rather than just commercial uses. Mm-hmm. And then further out from that, you'd see maybe a single family house here and there that was a bigger one than usual and wanted to have that Grand Avenue address that we don't seem to cherish anymore. Mm-hmm. And then the further out you get, and you begin to see smaller lot, still very nice single family homes, but on smaller lots, so that you can still get 8 or 9 units per acre. Mm-hmm. And generally you have streets that are either tree lined or have nice sidewalk furnishings, which would be benches and nicely designed lamp posts and bits of shade from awnings and this and that and the other thing, planters.
What about maintaining all those kinds of things? I'm sure that's a big factor.
Well, we talk about that, and yet drive down most commercial suburban streets today and you'll see a parking lot that has planters in it and lights in it and a strip between the parking lot and the arterial roadway that has grass and shrubbery, and all of which has to be maintained. And so I think for the most part we maintain that stuff, we just do it in a different realm, in a different way. And we've come to think that somehow, the interesting thing is I think people recognize that the kind of space I'm talking about feels much more public than the space around, say, a strip mall. And so we assume that the public then must be responsible for maintaining it. Whereas the strip mall, we know that those owners of that commercial development are going to maintain it for us. So we need to get back to the idea that although it is public realm, those individual owners should have the pride of ownership and maintain their storefront so that people will want to be there.
Right. Yeah, and they do, usually.
Yeah, yeah, generally, if it's a good public realm, if it's a good public space, then people both want to be there, and the people who own there want to maintain it, so people will be there.
Yeah. And also on the picture, I guess I'm struck by a literal picture that I've seen that you put on the slideshow of the tree-lined street, mm-hmm. where the sidewalk is behind the trees, mm-hmm. and a little bit shielded, but not blind from the roadway.
Right.
Providing that extra, I don't know, park-like sense, public space sense, but also the protection from cars, should
absolutely.
They go awry.
And yes, that's absolutely true. And it's interesting because we got into the habit of putting very narrow sidewalks on the very edge of very high-speed, wide roads, and assuming that if people didn't walk there, there was something wrong with people who might want to walk, not with the design. So the design gets down to not just the physical design of buildings, but also the design of the space. And that's where you do think about, okay, what does it take as a pedestrian to feel safe walking here? And that extra space between you and the roadway is a very important factor. The trees are important because if a car were to go awry, they're going to hit the tree before they hit you. Mm-hmm. That's an important thing. Mm-hmm. Another thing people don't think much about, but if you have a bike lane on the edge of a roadway, it serves certainly a great purpose for bikers, and it's a wonderful thing. I bike a lot, and my route, I use a route that includes bike lanes on purpose because I feel much safer riding there. So it's great for bikers, but it's also good for drivers. There's a man who started in the Department of Transportation in Florida by the name of Dan Burden, who points out that there's 22 good things about bike lanes, and one of them is for bikes. The other 21 are for cars, and it's that if you're a driver and you wander accidentally or another car pushes you out of your lane, there's a space for you to go, and hopefully there's not a biker in that space immediately as those things happen, which is often not the case. You know, very, very rarely would that happen. But it gives you as a driver some extra space to respond to incidents that might happen around you on the road. Mm-hmm. So bike lanes are great for bikers, and I advocate them absolutely, but they're not just good for bikers.
I bike some, especially I'm a good weather biker. Mm. And I've always wondered as I bike, even with a bike lane, if there isn't a better way on that too. I would rather have that tree line barrier. Is that even feasible? And I'm all...
Well, it is probably. It would require a fairly big shift both in our mentality and in the way we spend money on infrastructure. Probably the best example around the world is in Denmark. They have an incredibly high bike rate, close to 50% mode split, if I remember my numbers correctly. And they do have a separated system for bikes, where bikes are on their own pathway system. And yet, that pathway system is integrated into this traffic light system, into everything else. So that as a biker, it's not a secondary system that you're being shunted off to the side. It's a very primary system, but it's separate. Huh. And so, yes, you can have that. And certainly, at some, of course, their land mass is very much smaller than ours. And we do have some distance to cover to get there, both literally and figuratively. But, at least bike lanes, I think the idea now is to make sure that bikes and pedestrians have a space that's dedicated just to them. And at least if you have that, you're much safer than you are if you don't have a space that's dedicated to you.
Right. Otherwise, I think of other places like developing countries where Everybody shares the same road, and the reason the cars go slow enough to not hit the bikes and the mules and the walkers and everybody else is because the roads are so potholed that they have to go slow.
There's both that, and then there's the theory that if you don't have any traffic control at all and just leave everybody to their own devices, everybody is more careful because I'm not quite sure what it is they can and can't do.
Yeah, but it does become a lot more interesting.
Yeah.
That's really a good way.
However, it statistically isn't necessarily safer, but it does slow people down. But there are ways to design it in the sort of realm that we have today that still slow people down and produce, I think, maybe better safety.
Yeah. I feel safer on our roads.
Yeah.
But I do find it interesting to see those other roads. Particularly when there were elephants also as transportation.
Oh, I bet that would be very interesting.
Very interesting, yeah.
And that's not to say that you shouldn't have some streets that are shared spaces. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's some movement in this country to go back to lanes and other very narrow roads where, in fact, you do... the purpose is to share the road. And if you as a driver know that this is not a road where you're intended to go anything faster than 15 or 20 miles an hour. You're intended to share with whoever else might be there at the time.
Yeah.
And it's working in some new urbanist communities that have tried it on a limited basis, but I haven't had a chance to really study any data from it.
The other item I wanted to touch on was, I can see this newly designed area going in and this development going in, and it has all these great things. What do we do with the old places?
Yeah.
And in particular, those cut off, windy road suburbs where there's no connection to roads behind them and they're big lots and all of that.
You know, retrofitting suburbia is going to be an interesting problem. I don't have a solution. There's some solutions emerging. And I think it comes down to a community-by-community discussion about what your goals are and what you envision for that area and what you're willing to give up or not or pay for or not. It will be, in some instances, costly to retrofit. In other instances, it will mean changing the pattern from one of large lot single family to one that subdivides those lots once or twice and increases the density somewhat. If you can do that, then you can afford at some point to buy one or two of the lots here and there and create connections. So those are some of the ideas that are being talked about. Another idea that's emerged in some places is to recognize that there are some places that probably shouldn't have density increased and just accept that, but in accepting that, actually make them move back more rural than what they are. Accept animals, keep the large lots. But if you're going to have a large lot, it should serve a purpose. What's the purpose?
Gotcha.
And so there's a lot of ideas being kicked around. I don't know that we've come up with a great solution yet. So I think it'll probably be a place to experiment for a while, which may be interesting.
Are there little experiments? I mean, with little changes that make, like just putting a connector path?
Of course, in new developments, there are a lot of places where they're still allowing cul-de-sacs and allowing windy roads, but are also requiring at least pedestrian and bike connections between. There are a few places that are trying to retrofit those kinds of connections into existing disconnected windy street systems. And to the extent that there's a good destination on the other side of that path, that's a successful thing to do. Mm-hmm. You have to be a little bit careful. There's a lot of resistance to it too, because people are worried that if there's a connection next to their house, then somebody not from the neighborhood is going to walk on it and create some issues. That's not very likely, but you can prevent some of that if you, again, design it well. Design becomes an important issue. If you create a 6-foot tall fence tunnel for the connection where nobody can see in or out, you can create situations that aren't very safe. But if you figure out a way to get that connection through where somebody can still have eyes on it, either somebody from one of the houses nearby or the street or whatever, and the fences aren't quite so tall, then It's not a place where people can hide and do nefarious things. It's a place where people move through. Yeah. So, you know, design is always important.
Yeah. One other question before I let you go today, or one other topic at least, is how did you get into this? What's your evolution to become a smart growth expert?
Well, it's an interesting story. I live in an older neighborhood that has good walking, and I was out with my three very small children one day walking to the store, and one of them in stroller, and you know, one in hand, and the other hopefully staying nearby. And but you know, a great place to walk, so we were okay. And as we came around the corner, there was a bulldozer up the street. Now, what's going on up there? So we walked up, and as we got there, the bulldozer took a swath out of a historic house in my neighborhood, as I learned later, was tearing it down so they could build a parking lot there for the church next door. And not only did they tear the house down, but they didn't bother to salvage the stained glass windows in the transom that I watched get destroyed by the bulldozer. They didn't bother to salvage the beautiful oak woodwork. And I was just horrified at the waste, at the lack of respect for the neighborhood, at all kinds of things. And relatively young mother, my professional career at that point was graphic design. I'm an artist by training. And just said, by golly, I got to do something about this. So I contacted my neighborhood association and said, this is wrong. What, you know, how can I help? And ended up getting involved in the Neighborhood Association a short time later, a couple of years later, was the president of the Neighborhood Association. And an issue came before us on a natural area very near our neighborhood that was being proposed for a big development. They were going to take wetlands out and channelize a creek and tear, you know, cut down a bunch of trees. And as it turned out, effort formed to preserve it. I was integral to working out a solution that allowed the developer to find a way to go forward with a little bit of the housing to help pay the costs they'd already sunk into it. And learned a lot about planning, about, you know, working out compromises, about city government, and became very interested. Went on to manage a campaign of one of the leaders of that effort to run for city council. And shortly afterward, applied for a job at Idaho Smart Growth. And 12 years later, I've spent a lot of hours learning about how to do this.
So did you join the city council yourself after you were with Idaho Smart Growth?
Yes. Oh. Yeah. So when I helped my friend run for city council, I had a very young child at the time, 6 months old, and made a promise to her when my child turned 12, I would consider running myself. Mm. And so I did.
So you're taking turns, or is she still on?
Well, no, she's no longer there. She's doing on to better and bigger things, on to other things.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's a great story. I'm glad I asked.
Thank you.
I wonder if your angst, if I don't know if that's the right word, at seeing the building getting torn down, though, if that, how you balance that kind of feeling with the patience it requires to go through processes and planning and all of that.
That's a great question, because it does require a lot of patience. And I thought I had that down until I got elected to city council. And then I thought, well, gosh, as a city council member, I ought to be able to make differences quickly. Mm-hmm. Not so much. Mm-hmm. Not so much. Although I think, you know, if you look back over time at the legacy that you build over time, it begins to make some sense that you're actually making a difference. So, you know, I look back and complete changes in parking policies in that part of the city where that building got torn down, the nature preserve that we were able to get preserved, and, you know, various other things. So, you know, over time it works, but yeah, it takes a lot of patience. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Well, I have too. Thank you.
Elaine Clegg is the co-director of Idaho Smart Growth, and she's on the city council in Boise, Idaho. She spoke with me in May 2010 in Moscow, Idaho. This Yin Radio program is all about growing smart. And you may think that that concept, growing smart, can't be applied to hair. But I'm going to make that attempt. Because Colleen McCall grew her hair and cut it for some very smart reasons. Installment number 3 is called Colleen Sheds.
Colleen McCall cut her hair recently. She had long, smooth hair, a chestnut color with bounce and shine, TV commercial quality hair. It ran over her shoulders to mid-back. A few weeks ago, she cut it short. This was not the first time Colleen went from long to short in one fell swoop. It's part of her history to do that.
It kind of starts back from when I was a kid, my whole hair story. When I was a young kid, probably in the fourth grade, my hair was pretty long, and my sister always had a very hard time with her hair. She would cry. She never wanted my mom to brush it. And so my mom cut her hair off, all the way off, like Dorothy Hamill style. And my sister didn't cry anymore. She didn't love it. But since it was so easy for her, she took me in and had all of my hair cut off. And it was kind of traumatic.
She thought she looked like a boy. And she never had any issue with her hair. So why did mom have to do it? For her own convenience, not to help Colleen. So Colleen did what any normal kid would do. Rebel. Colleen's version of rebellion was really tame, though. She simply let her hair grow. And grow. And grow. Kind of like she was afraid to lose it again.
So from then on, I just started growing my hair out, and it got very long. It was down past my waist towards the end of high school, and I went through part of college like that. And mid-college, I decided, this has been a security blanket for me for way too long. It's time for it to go.
And so she chopped it off and let it grow again.
I let it grow out again because it was sort of the easiest way for me to have my hair. It didn't take a lot of work, and I always got a lot of compliments on my hair because it has always been fairly healthy and sort of an interesting color for people. And so that helps to reinforce why you think you should hang on to all of this hair. And my dad was always a big fan of long hair, and I think that helped to have me want to have long hair, because of course you want your parents to think that you're beautiful, and if something is of value to them, it somehow inherently becomes of value to you. And so my hair was very long again into my 20s, and when I finished graduate school, I was ready to shed all of that again. And so I got up the courage to cut it all off, and I got it cut short, pixie style, short like a boy, and I put myself into a little bit of shock around that, but I loved it. I loved how freeing it was, but I don't think I was ready for having short hair.
Now, I understand the trauma she felt to have such a big change, and hairdressers are savvy about the traumatizing effect of major changes. So how does she get a hairdresser to take her in one sitting from below the waist hair to a pixie?
I took in a picture. Like, I had gone onto one of those websites where you could put the different styles onto the picture of your face. And it gave directions on how she could get that cut that I wanted. And the cut was really cute, and I loved it. And then it was just sort of like, oh my gosh, what did I do? And so she was concerned about that, but I convinced her while I was sitting in the chair that this is what I really wanted. And it was what I wanted. It was just sort of like that shock afterwards of, you have to have this for a really long time now. That was when I was in graduate school. When I had just finished my master's degree, and I was sort of just in a place in my life where I needed change, and I felt like my hair had become just made my face look very drab. And so I had been married, and it was probably about a year after my husband and I got married, I was like, I am cutting off all my hair. I just finished my master's degree. I need a change. I'm going to just, today's the day. And he was like, all right. And my husband actually really likes short hair on women, in fact, prefers it. And here I am always having long hair. And so it's not like it was, it's not like he was telling me no. He's always just sort of been neutral about the whole thing, whatever I want. Which is nice, considering I had a father that was always very traumatized when I would cut off my hair. So I did. I cut it all off, and I decided that, you know, I had all of this hair, and it should go to somebody who needed it. And so I had that hair for donation, and it was pretty great. But the traumatizing part was that I had made this huge change, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And sometimes it would seem fine, but there's some sort of security that I felt by having tension on my hair from a ponytail that was gone, and I couldn't find that again. And so it, not after much time, I started growing it out again.
This time, Colleen donated her hair to charity so it could be made into wigs for people who need them, especially cancer patients. This was the first time she had done that, but not the last.
And then that brings me to my most recent shed. Yeah. Last year, my mom was diagnosed with cancer. And so she went through the whole chemotherapy process and had lost her quite a bit of her hair, not all of her hair, through that. And obviously, the donating hair for wigs thing had been important to me before. But my hair was getting to be the length where it could be cut again. I sort of started to think of myself as a hair farm, like a, I could just grow it off and then cut it, you know, grow it and then cut it off for other people who can't grow their own hair or need it for something special. So I had been thinking about it for quite some time, and on this last go around, and with my mom being sick, she, you know, that was just sort of hard, and I knew that I would donate it again. And so finally, I'd been thinking about it a lot, and I thought, today's the day. If I go in and I've got enough hair to donate, today's the day I'm getting rid of all my hair. And when I went in to my hairdresser, it was funny because she was like, are you sure you want to do this? Your hair is going to be very short afterwards. And I was like, yes, I have had short hair before. It's going to be just great. And it was interesting how she was almost trying to talk me out of it, like I was doing something rash or hadn't put enough thought into it, when really it had been something I was thinking about for 6 months or better.
And it was just like that. She thought about it for a while, but when the right day came, she just knew it.
I woke up and I thought, today's the day, I'm getting rid of my hair. I need it, I need a change, I need to shed again. So I feel like with every time I chop off all of my hair, I'm chopping off all of those years, and I'm starting fresh on a new journey. And so it's kind of great. You know, my mom, she has cleared all of her tests, and my hair has gone to help somebody who needs hair, and just sort of restarting this year on a, you know, a different note. Shedding all of the stuff that was good and bad from the past years and starting out fresh with a new, I don't know, new path and a new look.
Colleen McCall cut her hair in January for the fourth time. It was the second time she donated her hair. It may or may not be the last time she grows and sheds her hair.
That wraps up our show about growing smart. I'm going to share some music from Alison Krow, a regular on Yin Radio, to take us out today. This is called Double-Edged Sword.
Train of Francis. Maybe this is just my imagination. If so, ignore this proclamation. And hell, now I'm filled with indignation. So please accept my resignation.
You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a much-needed contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation and by me. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. I'm glad you could join me. Until next week.